Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
Considering he got sacked with 8 games of the season to go after nearly 10 years at the club, you could forgive Sean Dyche if he didn't feel like he wanted to really be Burnley's number one fan in their final push to avoid relegation from the Premier League. But I must say, he did a pretty good job of sounding like he wanted them to stay up during his world-exclusive interview with Richie on the Players' Chair last week. That was just one of the many highlights of our trip to London, which culminated in one of our favourite live shows of all time in front of the best crowd you could possibly wish for. The only low light. Well,
that it had to end on. That it had to end.
That I had to pay £35 in Frank Lampard's pub for 3 beers and a sparkling water. But listen, I'll stop banging on about that at some stage, I'm sure.
I hope the guy
has to make a living.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's making a hell of a living, Owen.
Hell of a trip that was. Hey, Ken.
Owen, how are you doing?
What a crowd, Ciarán. What a crowd at the Earth Theatre in Hackney.
Yeah.
Bloody nice bunch of people.
It was. The hall was big, Owen. I don't want to say it was intimidating, but it was pretty intimidating. It was an intimidatingly sized hall, an intimidatingly sized stage even. It felt like, looking around, it felt like we were maybe like 300 to 400 meters away from our production team that were also on the stage. But it was
a big production, yeah. A lot of cans being opened, a lot of cans of beer, which were being served and then being ostentatiously opened. Yeah.
Based on the bar take, there must have been at least 3,000 cans.
Mm.
And, if the show, including intermission from sort of start to finish, took around 150 minutes, that's a ring pull every 3 seconds.
It sounded like that.
It felt like that. It did feel like that at times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just getting into something really poignant here, and then it's like...
Let me get myself settled here.
Are people taking the piss? Literally, yeah. It sounded as though the crowd was mocking.
Yeah. Well, Shane Horgan made the point that people's personality types could be garnered from the sound they made. There were some just real quiet ones,
really
like trying to be
ones.
Nice. Yeah, real careful. And then some just, I don't give a fuck.
I've got like a gallon-sized can here and I'm not afraid to open it. That's what it sounded like.
Oh man, good times. Shane Duffy was among our guests at that one. Richie was there too. But Richie still found time to get to Nottingham the day before to meet with his old mate Dyche, who was the guest on the very first episode of The Player's Chair. You might remember that a few years ago. This one was an amazing interview during the week. I could not get over how relaxed Dyche was in Richie's company. Old teammates at Millwall, of course. Dyche was making the point that he wants the club to stay up because he feels that that is actually what will add to the legacy. So in another 10 years time, they're still a Premier League club. Fans look back and say, oh, Dyche and his lot, they're the ones who built the foundations for this. So that's what he's saying anyway. He also gave his own version of events around the Everton stuff, his final game in charge. And the Everton match after Burnley. No, of course, they then lost in March. Yeah. So, you know, these don't know how to win, lads, is what he revealed to his players. And he's tried to clarify that. He says he confirmed what Lampard had said, which was that he contacted Lampard to try to clear all that up. And he also talked about the sack. There's loads, absolutely loads of stuff. There's no point trying to summarise the whole interview. But I'll play you one clip here. This is Dyche talking about the sacking itself, how he found out, and then how he relayed the news to his players.
Alan Pace, like I say, no lack of respect for Alan. Good guy. Had an open conversation during the whole time.
He rings you and says...
No, just says, could I meet you in the morning? Obviously, you are thinking, that's peculiar, an early morning meeting.
Is that what you thought?
Yeah, of course. I was in the gym. I saw him walk past the window. I said, yeah, I'll be up in 1 minute. Just come out of the gym, walked up. Very simple, civil conversation. Going to make a change. Okay, you've known me a long time. So yeah. I don't know, you know, I'm not one to collapse and heap and all that. You know, of course, over time, when I look back, there'll be an emotional viewpoint of my time at Burnley because of what was achieved. And all that. But at the moment, it's still pretty fresh. It's still pretty real. Therefore, I'm like, okay, is everything going to be looked after sensibly? Yes. I said, no problem at all.
Is that like you make that that it's like a 5 or 10 minute exchange? Is it?
Oh, no, it's less than that. Because there's a maturity. I just said, look, if it's okay with you, I'd like to conduct the morning meeting with the staff. I'd like to speak to the players. He said, yep, absolutely. I said, lads, just to let you know, we're done. I'd like to thank you all for all your work for the varying stages of my career here. I wish you well. Go and win on Saturday. Shook their hands. Disappeared. Bye.
Okay, you're describing a scenario which would have taken 25 seconds, bar that, plus the handshake.
Yeah, probably with handshakes about a couple of minutes.
Emotional, eh? Jeepers, that is cold all round. A couple of handshakes. Sorry, man, I'm sacked now. He texted his family as well, and he texted his family and said, "Been sacked. I'll catch you in due course."
In due course.
So this is, yeah, it's, you know, 10 years, not much emotion. Certainly not much overt emotion.
What more is there to say, Owen?
I know. It's perhaps not surprising that it's always going to feel cold and brutal when it ends. But we've got a pretty clear example of that. So that full interview is available now on the World Service. So is our Shane Duffy chat on stage in Hackney. And thanks again to Aer Lingus for getting us over there. And to all of our London listeners for making it such a special occasion. Dion Fanning and Gavin Cooney coming up on today's show after your report on sport, Kenny.
Well, Owen, I'm surprised that you didn't ask me if I had a good time myself. You only seem to be interested in Ciarán's opinion.
Well, I know you had a good time. I saw.
I did.
No, I did
have a good time. I don't jump
to conclusions, on. You know, Ken is a mystery wrapped inside a riddle, wrapped inside an enigma. Who knows? Who knows what he thinks at any given moment?
I realised I hadn't been in London for like 3 years, and I hadn't been in Brexit Britain, unless you count Northern Ireland, which, you know, debatable. I hadn't been in Brexit Britain at all since, you know, their Declaration of Independence, which meant that I was surprised by the duty-free, the real duty-free. I almost was, like, regretting that I didn't still smoke. There were such incredible bargains on offer. So it was, you know, I tasted the benefits of freedom, at least. And I really enjoyed being in London, actually. I was like, this place, you know what a good thing to do is in London? Just walk around it.
Yeah.
Maybe just don't always be diving for the underground. You know, I hate the being underground and, you know, kind of walking around those huge tunnels with, like, you know, in huge crowds of people. It just kind of, I don't know if
anybody enjoys that. It's a necessary evil.
You know, I don't think you can live in London without, like, you know, being able to handle that. You know, it's something that I think a lot of Londoners just sort of deal with. Me, I like the fresh air, Owen. And that's why this time I walked around. Walking, you know, it's underrated. I didn't used to do enough of it in the old days. I used to think, well, it's too far to walk. It's never too far to walk. just get, you'd be surprised how quickly you get there. And I was walking around having a good time thinking, yeah, you know.
Where
London.
Did you walk, Ken? Where was I while you were doing all this walking, all this prodigious walking?
I just did a bunch of walks, Murph. I don't know what you were doing. You were in your hotel room, I think. Were you not? I was here in your hotel room, and I was
probably just on the internet, Murph. I was living life.
No, it was very nice. It was great, and hopefully it won't be 3 years before I'm back there. That's my anyway. Owen, thanks for asking me about that.
No, I'm glad to hear it. I really regret not asking you now.
So where are we? Also in London, but not enjoying it as much as me. Pep Guardiola, just a stone's throw, Owen, from where we were.
I knew that to be a segue.
Just
to all that
a stone's throw. From where we were, Manchester
City. Ken doesn't usually open up on his feelings unless there's a segue in mind. Our suspicions were proved correct there.
He went to the London Stadium and he came back with a point. And he described the situation Manchester City are in now as an incredible privilege. After, you know, they now have one game to win the league. But of course, they had one penalty to win the league against West Ham. And that penalty did not go in. And I was only watching this that I realised that I thought Fabianski saved a few recently. And look at the statistics. Fabianski is the greatest penalty stopper in the history of the Premier League.
Oh, go on.
He has saved 13 penalties in the Premier League, according to Transfermarkt. Although 11, according to the Premier League. So I can only conclude 11 is still the most that anyone's done. Like the next was like Aurelio Gomez had 9. Rob Green, a West Ham legend in his day, had 9. Ben Foster had 9. Stick around and play a lot of games and you will eventually save some penalties, but not as many as Fabianski unless you're extraordinarily good. Fabianski has, I think, a 68%. You've got a 68% chance of scoring a penalty against Fabianski, which is pretty good because the average is 83% of penalties converted. In the Premier League.
So he is impressive.
Yeah, he's significantly outperforming. So this is a guy who, I thought this is kind of amazing that, like, at this moment, City found this guy barring their path. You know what I mean? It's kind of like the whole game yesterday just had a lot in it, which I don't think this is going to be a nice week for Manchester City at all. As they, you know, it's like a game against Aston Villa at home. It's so easy. It's so easily winnable when you're Manchester. They have just been chewing up the likes of Aston Villa. You know, this is just not a game that's going to cause problems. But, like, the West Ham game has not been a game that's caused them any problems either, really. You know, since Guardiola's been the manager, this is a game they usually win. But here they are. They arrive at West Ham and they're missing key defensive players. And this is like, you know, City have been pretty quiet about this. You know, in terms of, like, it's not like they've been sort of hysterically sort of squawking, saying, oh, you know, this is a disaster. Like, how are we going to get through these games without, but like most of their defense is gone. like Kyle Walker and Ruben Diaz are only two of the four regular back four players, but they are more than half of the defense in terms of what they actually provide. I mean, Cancelo is a playmaker. You know what I mean? Cancelo is a really attacking fullback. Yeah. Walker is the one whose job it is to sweep behind the defense in this huge space. And Diaz is like the guy who provides the power in the center of defense. And instead, Stones is out as well. Stones would be playing instead of either of those guys, but he's actually injured. So instead they've got Laporte, who is like a conductor, you know, like... The Laporte in his most imperious mode for Man City is striding forward with the ball at his feet and then arrowing a pass out to the left winger, which takes like a couple of opposing players out of the game with one ball. That's Laporte, right? And instead it's like you've got this great orchestrator, this great conductor, you know, like imagine an orchestral conductor who is now... Actually, what you've got him is he's on a desert island. He's marooned by himself and his job is to find a way to crack open coconuts, right? Yeah. His skills are useless. Like he's in a situation where he's out of his comfort zone. And it adds up to a really really vulnerable defense. And Jarrod Bowen and West Ham showed this with such simple attacks. Now, I have to say that Bowen's finishing was unbelievable. Right, because I didn't think either of the chances that he had I didn't think he was going to score either of them.
First one especially I thought was brilliant. The first one was when he ended up at the tight angle, and then with a defender sliding back to cover the rolled finish, and he managed to whack it over the defender. I thought the second one was it that cleanly hit? I wasn't sure. He didn't seem to be that well set for the second one, but sort of found a way.
Well, I didn't think he was going to score. The first one was a brilliant finish. The second one, I still kind of can't believe it went in. And
yeah,
you've got to look at Ederson and think, like, okay, the ball goes through Fernandinho's legs, which always makes it more difficult for the goalkeeper. You know, like he shoots sort of through the legs of Fernandinho. He gets a bit lucky the way that happens, I guess. I mean, if he's meaning to do it, then fair play. Even more credit to Jared Bowen. But I did feel Ederson just sort of let it go past him pretty easily. It wasn't into the corner, you know. Maybe that's what happens when, I guess, he was quite advanced in his position. You know, like Ederson obviously does like to get out of his goal mouth, but that's not always the best place to be when you're facing a guy who's actually going to shoot from just outside the box, and the ball is past him before he can react. But at this point, you're thinking, well, this is, you know, I mean, now City are in big trouble. 2-0 down away to West Ham with the way that they've been playing this season. They're probably not going to win this. This suddenly, everything has opened up. And it did look, of course, like they were going to win it. I mean, Grealish scored the goal. Did you see Grealish's reaction to scoring?
He didn't even smile.
He didn't.
What were you going to say, Karen?
No, I didn't take note of his reaction. He didn't smile. Well, I mean, you're not supposed to smile. 2-1 down, after 49 minutes, you score a goal. Get back to the halfway line. It was an ideal opportunity for you to show that you're a top pro.
It was business. Like, he ran back with a worried look on his face, and it was like, yeah. And then obviously then there was an own goal, a spectacular Keith Houchin own goal, diving header by Soufal. Mm-hmm. And then this penalty. And just Mahrez. And this is another strange thing. Why are City so bad at penalties? Because you've seen Mahrez, right? Mahrez has not only missed against... Fabianski. In fact, he was Fabianski's first victim. He was the first guy who he stopped scoring a penalty in the league back in 2016. But his record in the Premier League is, at the moment when he steps up to take a penalty, 70%, which is like well below average. You know, again, if I say the average is 83, like 83% of penalties are scored, then... to a guy who's only scoring 70, is this really the best guy we have? You know, you're looking around the City team going, really? You know, I can remember Mahrez missing a big penalty for City before against Liverpool at Anfield, if you remember that game. That was in 2018-19. City ended up winning the league that season, of course. But early in the season, they drew 0-0 at Anfield, and Mahrez had the chance late at the end of the game to win it and missed entirely. So you're kind of thinking, this is really our best guy. And then you look around and actually he is the best option. I mean, if you do it statistically, Mahrez is the best penalty taker. De Bruyne's success rate in the league for City is 66%. He misses a third of his penalties. Sterling's on the bench. He's actually only scored 3 out of 7. Like, how have you been able to do this? Like, Cancelo has never taken one. Grealish has never taken one. I mean, who else was in the team? Rodri has 100% success rate, 1 out of 1. But you can't let Rodri take it. Like, Jesus also
Rodri's a decent striker of the ball. I remember that goal he scored a few weeks back.
I know, but imagine Rodri. Like, Rodri's not a goal scorer. You know, I mean, he actually has scored a few goals this season. He scored important goals. I mean, there was the one at Arsenal that sticks out in the memory. You know, you've got players like Mahrez and De Bruyne. They can't let Rodri step forward in that moment. They have to be the ones to take responsibility. And it's just it's a real shortcoming that City needs to look at. I mean, Klopp mentioned in his post, and I know this is one of those classic things where, oh, you know, you're not doing enough on this. But I do sort of think, actually, it is time they got on top of this. Like...
Does Pep think it's beneath him to actually coach players to score a penalty?
Like, he doesn't have to do it.
There's just so much more important things that happen on a football field.
Well, he literally doesn't have to do it. I mean, Klopp mentioned they got in touch with some... That Liverpool had got in touch with some firm who had said, you know, oh, we can help your penalties, to your players to be better at penalties. And Klopp's like, oh, okay, well, you know, if you want to give it a go. I mean, they have done things like this, you know, with the throws... and so on. You know, Liverpool have kind of moved into this area of micro coaching areas, and this... I mean, the penalty record they've had this season so far has been pretty good. Is it? I mean, in shootouts, it's like... what is it? I mean, they had 11 penalties, scored all of them in the Carabao Cup. And then was it 7 penalties and scored 6 in the FA Cup final?
Yeah.
This is pretty good. I mean, City are not... you know, the City have been, you know, I mean, again, this is all before Liverpool miss like 4 out of 5 in the Champions League final. You know, these type of things can happen. But I do wonder if the situation at City has, like, when Mara stepped up and missed, you thought, okay, well, one thing, Fabianski is really good at this, and it's just kind of an ironic thing that he ends up facing like the best goalkeeper at this in the history of the Premier League just at the moment when he needs to score to win the league. But they do need to get a bit better at converting those chances. And it's maybe something that they need to think about over the summer. But afterwards, Guardiola, well, he had a lot to say, but I noticed that one key message kept being repeated. I mean, here's post-match interview number one. I think this is with beIN Sports.
That I can assure you our Etihad Stadium will be sold out.
And here's post-match interview number two. I think this one is BBC.
And I'm pretty sure that the Etihad Stadium will be sold out.
And just in case people hadn't been watching his TV interviews, he says it again in the press conference.
Yeah, just I can assure you something. So in 1 week, our stadium will be sold out and we will give them all our lives in 195 minutes and they will give us their lives to all together to do it. It's an incredible privilege.
I find this very odd. I just don't understand why he's making such a big point about the Etihad Stadium will be sold out. Of course it's going to be sold out. It's the last home game of the season. You're playing for the league. Like, anyone would sell out. You know what I mean? It's like, it's kind of a mad thing to sort of...
Well, he's having to tread carefully, isn't he? Well, he's trying to rally the fans to create an amazing atmosphere to help get the team over the line.
He has to be a little
careful on that because, yeah, but other times he's tried to do that. He's ended up basically just criticising them and they haven't taken it too well.
Well, okay, there has been a bit of that where he said, you know, we need the people. Yeah, I see what you mean. Okay, maybe that is why he's doing it. I mean, yeah, it's sort of interesting though. I just sort of thought, yeah, I mean, of course it's going to be like that's not even in doubt, yeah. You know.
But please, Ken has accepted my as though I know what's going on in the mind of Pep Guardiola. I haven't got a clue. It's just my best guess.
I think you might be onto something there. You might be onto something because I couldn't really understand why he kept saying, like, because when a manager sort of repeats a line, it's because he wants that line out there, you know. And this was the line out of everything he could have said. This was the thing that he kept repeating. I can tell you one thing: the Etihad Stadium will be sold out. You're like, well, I mean, yes, but why he might say it like that? Okay, Owen, that is a good theory.
Yeah, and it's a huge thing for fans of teams other than Man City to throw back in their face now that their manager had to go and plead that it would be a sellout 7 days before they have a chance to win
well,
the Premier League.
He didn't plead; he promised.
Yeah, well, you can read it as promising. Another way of saying it is that this has to sell out. That's why I'm mentioning it. I mean, there can be no empty seat.
It just seems like a strange thing. I've never heard a manager promise that a massive title deciding game is going to be sold out. It's just like, well, of course it will be.
That's why I'm saying he's pleading, not promising.
Well, he has promised. He's not pleading. He said he's guaranteed. He's issued a personal guarantee. It just seems like a redundant point. It's like, yeah, any other obvious stuff you wanted? You know, a lot of people will be sitting on chairs, although they will stand for a lot of the game as well. You know, like, okay, well, we intend to get our fans off their seats, although they will be sitting in those seats at times. You know, like, okay. Look, it's all... Well, the point about it is that against expectations, certainly the expectation that I had last week when you saw City absolutely demolish Wolves, you know, with that sort of De Bruyne wonder show, you kind of thought they will finish the job this weekend. They haven't done that. Instead of which, they're up against...
Stephen Gerrard.
All these former Liverpool people, you know, and Tyrone Mings as well. I mean, you know, a lot is resting on the sturdy shoulders of Tyrone Mings here. You know, can he keep Man City at bay? And, you know, the expectation would have to be probably not. But the expectation equally from the City West Ham game yesterday was City will win this game. So expectations at this point of the season, who knows? Although the expectation that Thomas Tuchel had of his defender, Andreas Christensen, was that he would play in the FA Cup final. But no, because Christensen, just hours before the game, told Thomas Tuchel, actually, I've got a funny feeling in my tummy. I'm not sure if I can play today, coach. Can I be excused? And Thomas Tuchel said, yeah. And then Chelsea put it about that this had happened. Andreas Christensen obviously is leaving Chelsea on a free transfer, but he leaves now with the jeers and catcalls of the Chelsea fans in his ears, as opposed to, you know, Chelsea fans who might have been saying, I mean, okay, it hasn't been such a great season for Christensen. He's had a few injury issues, but if you think back just to October, that was the time at which. Wasn't that the time sort of Denmark were kind of confirming their World Cup qualification? And I remember the stat going around, Andreas Christensen, 42 clean sheets in his last 52 games for club and country, which is like phenomenal. You know, I mean, the Denmark, I think, played their World Cup qualifiers and didn't let in a goal, I think, in their first 9 matches or something.
Yeah, it was something ridiculous. Yeah.
And then obviously Tuchel had taken over at Chelsea and had kind of reduced the goals against kind of almost to nothing, and Christensen was a big part of that. Actually, since then, it's only 9 clean sheets in 24 matches, which shows both that the goals have started going in a bit more and he hasn't been playing as many games as he had been. So it's just an interesting little thing that Chelsea decided to sort of publicize this.
What was his actual reason? Because obviously he's leaving the club. So was it just not wanting to get injured ahead of moving, or why would he not have wanted to play?
I doubt that's it, because you know, I mean, it's not like, what's he got on this summer, like holidays? You know, Denmark already qualified for the World Cup. You know, it's not like he has to. Oh, I've got massive games at Denmark. Maybe they're playing Nations League or some nonsense. But you know, I mean. I don't think that's a major concern for him at this point. This is a chance to win a trophy. Remember, Chelsea have lost the previous 2 finals. You know, this is the third final in a row that they lost. You know, an Mason Mount-like run of Wembley defeats for Chelsea as a club. And I mean, I assume that he actually was sick, or you know, that he didn't feel up to playing. You know, I mean, it's not just a question of, do I feel like absolutely the best I've ever felt in my life. It's, am I capable of playing against Sadio Mane today? That's, you know, it's kind of a different standard. Maybe he just thought, I'm not up to this. If I play, I'm going to let the side down. But as it is, it sounds as though he's pulled out of the game because, or a lot of Chelsea fans rather seem to have taken the impression that this guy has pulled out of the game because he's leaving. He doesn't care about the club and he didn't want to put his body on the line for us. Well, we're well rid of this guy. When they might have been thinking, God, you know, this guy's one of the best young defenders, one of the best youngish, let's say, defenders in Europe, and he's walking out of our club, and that seems like we've made a right mess of that situation. You know what I mean? So, Chelsea playing the crowd there, I guess. What they're going to do with Lukaku, I don't know. I mean, Tuchel just abusing him from the sideline. You saw the scenes in this game, like, oh my God. But, you know, he had a really terrible game. Again, and obviously no one knows what's going to happen there this summer. It seems as though if Tuchel is still there, then maybe it would be best for everybody if Lukaku was to go, because I just don't feel as though he can. You get to a point with a coach and a player where, like, the lack of respect is too obvious. You know what I mean?
Well, that point came, I thought quite early on in the season, that even after Tuchel held him to task over his comments about the game plan and that sort of stuff. Even then, there was another, I think it was a week or so later, Tuchel was sort of still banging on about that. And you're like, okay, it's finished now. You said he's apologized, yeah. So it's done. You're still talking about that. And then anytime you're given any opportunity to go easy on him or to say something nice about him, you really don't take it. So you can also see the frustration from the manager's point of view, that he's, all this money was spent on this massive player who's supposed to transform the team, and actually it's just, if anything, it's had the opposite effect. So it's a mess of a situation.
It is, and he's obviously trying to avoid trying to separate himself from the responsibility for that £100 million lead balloon, although then again, the big picture situation of the club has changed a lot. So we don't even know yet who's gonna be owning. I mean, it looks like probably Todd Bowley, but it's not done yet. So we'll see. Just on the Christensen thing, though, it's sad that on the same weekend he misses out, probably entirely justifiably, with his stomach problem, stomach bug. Hugo Lloris and Dejan Kulusevski just heroically battle through their own vomiting bug, just puking everywhere. But nevertheless, struggling out in the field to be there for Tottenham, to be there and to drag Tottenham into the Champions League.
Did they puke on the field?
Oh, apparently they're puking all over the place. But in the words of Antonio Conte, they showed they are very professional and understand the moment well. The players were not in 100% physical condition. But Hugo is our captain. He never wanted to miss this game.
I thought at the COVID age, the safer, the professional thing to do was, if you're sick, you don't go into work regardless of...
They understand.
You're not supposed to spread
well.
Any bugs around the place, but listen.
So yeah, that's an unfortunate contrast, cruel contrast. A lot of people I know also sickened his stomach by the disgraceful conduct of Liverpool supporters.
Oh yeah.
House of Commons Speaker Sir Lindsay Hoyle said, "I utterly condemn any fans who booed Prince William at Wembley. The FA Cup final should be an occasion when we come together as a country. It should not be ruined by a minority of fans' totally shameful behaviour. In this year of all years, the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. This is dreadful." Karen Bradley of the Tory party, former culture secretary, also added, she's an MP, "It is utterly unacceptable and disgraceful that fans booed Prince William. I would urge the FA to take all necessary action and pursue those responsible." I mean, it's like they have to pursue about 40,000 people. Sir Ed Davey of the Liberal Democrats: "We have the most wonderful monarch. Those fans who booed do not represent their clubs or our country." I'm sure they don't. They wouldn't. They would say we don't represent the country, but they do represent their club. Michael Cole is a former royal correspondent, apparently, who appeared this morning on Good Morning Britain and had this to say.
Every time someone forwards me on something from Good Morning Britain, I'm like, this is going to be good. Like, some of the shit that gets said on this show is just, it blows my mind.
It's early on in the day. People haven't had a chance to wake their brains up to avoid saying stupid shit.
It's just, it never misses. Every time someone sends me on a link from that show, it's just gold.
Well, I think decency and taste and discretion come into it, because...
Well,
it's
but
very,
what's the
very
punishment,
well.
Then,
if
in your
you,
view?
If you, for instance,
for bad taste.
If you booed the national anthem in certain Protestant parts of Belfast, you might come off rather the worse. It is a provocative thing to do, and you saw
not because of the law, though. I mean, that would be a terrible thing.
Freedom of speech does have its limits. You can't, for instance,
not
shout fire.
You're not endorsing someone coming off badly because they do that in certain parts of the UK.
Well, certain areas are illegal. I mean, you cannot commit slander without open yourself up to being sued for defamation. You can't shout fire in a crowded theatre and if there is no fire.
Tom,
and there are limits, and you cannot throw around racial epithets without being arrested, possibly put in jail. So I'm just calling for a little bit of decency, a bit of niceness, a bit of courtesy and respect for our 96-year-old monarch, who has served this country for seven
years. But it does beg the question.
Yeah, and the Good Morning Britain host there, Susanna Reid, has a good...
That poor woman, by the way. Every time I see a clip, she's trying desperately to keep the conversation on planet Earth. I mean, she might be the hardest working woman in show business.
She has a sort of a polite but cold, like frosty smile. Which she was sort of slightly narrowed eyes, but like it's like the eyes don't light up with mirth. You know, this
permanently
sort of
disbelieving look on her face. I mean, I don't know. The show probably goes on for like 5 hours, and she could be a ray of sunshine for the 4 hours and 55 minutes I don't see. Well, every time I see one of these clips, she's like, "What the hell are you talking about, boss?"
She gave that cold smile when Michael Cole suggested that, you know, it's a pity the UVF weren't around to kick the shit out of Liverpool fans, you know, and. Although I suppose the implication is that the Chelsea fans really let the side down by failing to chastise them. But, you know, I did think it was interesting that he thought his mind immediately went to Belfast and not, you know, somewhere on the mainland to where the most devoted patriots would be, you know. Like, what about Glasgow? I mean, you know that as we speak, tens of thousands of Rangers fans are setting sail or taking wing to the southern Spanish city of Seville, known to history as the headquarters of none other than the Inquisition. So all I'm saying is, all eyes are going to be on Seville over the next couple of days. All eyes, including those of Graeme Souness, a Rangers legend and a Scottish football legend and a Patriot. I wouldn't say, and a Liverpool legend. I mean, he's the guy who almost brings this all together. I don't think that he would boo the Queen. I don't think that he would. Because what Graeme Souness wants overall is to see fans behave, particularly Rangers fans. As he says many, many times in this video, which was tweeted by the official Rangers Club Twitter account.
Hi, guys. This is a message for everyone going to Seville. Go there, have a super time, support your team. Our team has done incredibly well in getting there. And you think the journey we've been on for the last 10 years to be now playing in a serious European Cup final, fantastic achievement. They've done their bit. Now it's your turn. You have to turn up there, behave yourselves, have a party, but make sure you behave yourselves, because you're going there as an ambassador for our football club, our great football club, the great Glasgow Rangers. You must go there and behave. Otherwise, we've got all the trashy headlines, which would damage us for a long, long time. Please go there and behave yourselves. Have a super time.
So that's Graeme Souness using the word behave four times in the 19 seconds at the end of that thing. Just please, boys, boys and girls, please just go out there and, you know, put on a good show.
Behave yourself.
But not the kind of show that, you know, our enemies in the media are going to want to turn into the wrong sort of headlines. You know, none of us wants that. So let's enjoy the game, let's enjoy Seville, and let's, above all, behave.
Never forget the true nature of this city.
Listen, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the dogs, the filth. Here is someone who stood up.
And this bike, by the way, I'd only had for 2 weeks. What happened to it? Dublin happened to it. Dublin has kicked the shit out of the bike.
There was a few minutes when I blithely believed that I lived in a civilized city. I arrived home. It was already dark. There was rain and mud everywhere.
Oh my God, this town!
So I thought to myself, no need to drag my bike through the house, given that all I'm doing is, you know, getting changed and getting my stuff and going to the pool. So I'll just leave it here beside the front door. Not on the street. I was in the house for 8 to 10 minutes.
What tobacco is it? I don't know. I haven't put tobacco in ages. Just give me some.
And there's nobody on the street. And it's dark. And there's not even any foot traffic. Open the door. Bike's gone.
Oh my God, this town!
It's actually been taken from outside my front door in an 8 minute period of being unguarded. And this bike, by the way, I'd only had for 2 weeks. This bike was given to me by my brother.
Oh my God, this town!
And I'm thinking, why? What happened to it? Dublin happened to it.
Never forget the true nature of this city.
Right, well, we have ourselves a pretty interesting final week of the Premier League season. I think we can all agree on that one. On to talk about it, the 42.ie's Gavin Cooney. Hey, Gavin.
How are you?
And representing the currency, it's Dion Fanning. How are you, Dion?
Hi, Owen. How's it going?
Ah, not bad at all. Are you fairly pumped for this final? I mean, it's been a long season, but there's quite a bit still to be decided. Not least the title race after City left the door. Ajar enough to be excited about the title race for the final week?
Yeah, definitely. I'm kind of a little bit baffled by the idea that the draw at West Ham was a great result for Man City. Obviously, it means win at home on your final game, and City win the league. But it's still given some opportunity to Liverpool. Not as much, obviously, as it looked like when City were 2-0 down, but there is also the idea, you know, I think in some ways a defeat may have focused City's minds a bit more on what they have to do. I just thought, I was struck by Jack Grealish saying afterwards that how excited he was now at the prospect of winning a Premier League title at home, you know, next Sunday. And it was kind of, Now, it may be that Grealish is watching it from the stand and is as excited as any other Manchester City supporter in the ground. But it did strike me as a little bit like, okay, this is going to be a fantastic carnival next Sunday, and I think it's not as good a result for Manchester City as that kind of commentary would suggest.
It's better than a defeat, though. You said there that you think a defeat would have focused the minds even further. Surely just the fact that they know they have to win will keep the minds focused enough.
Yeah, probably. But at the same time, a defeat would be kind of nobody would be going around saying after a defeat, this is that's a great result for Manchester City. Whereas the draw perhaps allowed them to think. Now it's still in their hands, and the one thing a defeat did was allowed Liverpool, notionally at least, a chance that they could win it, no matter what City did if they were to overtake their goal difference. And again, and then the other crucial thing, of course, is that Liverpool still have to beat Southampton on Tuesday, and at the moment, I think they are struggling in some ways to win any game comfortably. So that's something that still needs to be, if you're going to get it to the final day with a real excitement, or get it to the final day at all, that needs to happen.
Yeah, that'll happen. Southampton will roll over, I think, but we'll see on Tuesday night. Okay, well, Southampton, like, you know, everybody's on their rolling
every year people start war gaming the fixtures at the end of the season and forgetting that you can't really look. We might get on to Everton at some stage, but like, if you had wargamed Everton's last two fixtures with Watford and Brentford, you wouldn't have said 1 point.
I know. I just think Southampton have a real soft underbelly. They are a team that likes to, you know, get hammered 9-0 on occasion and 6-0, and you know, even this season they've had results like that. So they seem like good opponents for me to be playing. I take your point there. And Brentford, Gavin, what about the halftime team talk from Pep Guardiola, which was apparently low on technical detail and high on emotion? It was all about how much he loved his players. That's how he turned it around.
Yeah, maybe to borrow the phrase that John Bruin has been using on this podcast, did he just ultimately say to get it launched? Because that is ultimately what they did in the latter stages of that second half. I think they just upped the intensity. They were very weirdly torpid and kind of off key in that first half. You can put that down to West Ham coming out and having a bit of a go at them, and also down to their very fragile and changed defensive line. But I think West Ham invited the City onto them a little bit in the second half. I thought like their counter-attacking game, they just kind of forgot to do it until it got back to 2-2. So I think that West Ham were almost set up inviting City onto them. They raised the intensity, and they did add a little bit more width in their game, I think, in the second half. And you know, Grealo's intervention shortly after halftime certainly was the perfect setup for them.
Well, speaking of him, there was a couple of Irish has-beens out there. And at least one never was an Irishman, in the form of Rice, Grealish, and obviously the dear, soon to depart Mark Noble. And I just wondered when you saw Rice and Grealish, you know, disputing this the destiny of the Premier League title, which one of them do you wish had stayed Irish? It's an academic question, but I just wonder if you could only pick one, if you could pick one, which one would it be?
Yeah, I'd pick Grealish, I have to say. Just in terms of like a pragmatic, in terms of impact on the pitch. I mean, him in the Ireland team would be very similar to him in the Aston Villa team. Now, like, Martin O'Neill might still be the manager if Jack Grealish was decided he was Irish. But
he could have picked him, you know.
He could have picked him. But had he picked him, O'Neill might still be in the
job. Did you see Grealish with that map? I mean, I'm not sure. Grealish would have played, you know. I don't know if Grealish would have raised an objection. He was like, you want me to play? Sure, you know. I'm not sure he would have necessarily been like, well, you know, I'd love to play, but on the other hand, that might close off certain possibilities I had been.
Are you still talking about Jack Grealish declaring for England?
Well, I didn't realise.
There's a lot
until recently that,
you know, may I humbly suggest we
I'm just not sure how attached he really is to the idea of England, given that he literally didn't recognize it when presented with a picture of it. I just feel as though, well, look, again, there's no point in
I'm reminded of him giving Prince William so lustily booed at Wembley on Saturday evening. I'm reminded of Jack Grealish picking Prince William out of the crowd after Villa got promoted, and you know,
he's a Villa. It's not because Prince William is Prince William. It's because Prince William is a massive Villa supporter.
But also, I mean, Jack Grealish.
But he would fit in entirely. Like the obsession, the Irish obsession with the royal family is probably bigger than my wife, who's English, an anti-royalist, finds it extraordinary since we moved here. The amount of people who try and engage her in conversation about the royal family, and she's like, so like even in those terms, Jack Grealish could have probably fitted in quite well, but. I thought you were kind of getting the point, Ken, that if you know, if a guy doesn't know where he actually is at the moment, you could probably persuade him that the regulations about playing for Ireland wouldn't, you know, necessarily stop him doing something else in the future, and we could have hoodwinked him into playing for Ireland, which is also
hoodwink is a nasty word, but simply the fact would have been that he would have played, and you know, and I suppose he would have had to accept it. Would you agree with Gav that he's? I mean, again, I can actually sense Owen's irritation. He didn't say anything, but I can slightly sense his irritation that I'm asking
this question.
That I'm wasting.
I'm going to take a back seat for the next.
This is a question about Ricey. I mean, did you think Ricey ran the show?
I think Ricey ran the show yesterday.
Yeah, did you think Ricey dictated the game to Man City? Do you think Pep Guardiola was sitting there and Ricey, unparalleled to stop Ricey, running the show as a, you know, this is, we're talking about 150 million pound rated midfielder now.
No, I didn't. I think to go back to the point about West Ham in the second half, I think that's when you would have wanted somebody to override perhaps the fatalism coming from David Moyes on the sideline, and who came out afterwards and said we did well to keep them only to two goals, in a classic David Moyes example of, you know, this is a fantastic we only let in two and missed and saved a penalty. And I think you wanted a midfielder at that point. It would have been that would have been the real time when you see a midfielder kind of driving West Ham forward and kind of getting them out of the kind of defensive mindset they had got into. So, you know, I didn't see that. And I think, to quickly answer the question, I would definitely have Grealish if there was to be one, because, again, international football, I think he would have... it wouldn't even have been at Aston Villa. It would have been if Aston Villa were relegated... that would be, you know, you'd just have a player who would have time on the ball, who would be creating chances, and I think he would have been a huge player for Ireland internationally.
Gav, do Man City look vulnerable at all to you?
Well, they certainly looked vulnerable in the first half yesterday. I mean, their backline is pretty stitched together now, I have to say. Fernandinho's definitely showing his age. Laporte is a very strange defender. He was outstanding in his first season, and you're wondering, you know, France and Spain are going to fight to the death over this guy, and he's just looked so rickety since, you know. And then the replacement, Zinchenko at left back, is prone to lapses in concentration. And they really miss Kyle Walker. They really miss his pace on to cover counter-attacks. They really missed it, particularly yesterday. Like, he had both the pace and physicality to deal with Antonio, whereas Fernandinho had neither, and he really, really struggled. So I think they look vulnerable in that sense. And that's where Aston Villa are an interesting test this weekend, because I think Gerrard might go after this in one respect. They've looked a lot better since they've got Ings and Watkins in the team. Both of them caused Liverpool some bother in that game against at Villa Park last week. So I think they're, like, if Liverpool fans and Steven Gerrard, chief among them, is clinging to something, they can cling to that. But it's just, you know, further forward, they just dominate the ball so much, and they just strangle the life out of games. And if their mentality is right from the off, which I don't think it was at West Ham, it is really hard to see those defensive vulnerabilities being exposed by Aston Villa.
Yeah. I mean, Villa's record away to City since the takeover is played 10, lost 10, scored 4, conceded 34. Which is actually quite similar to West Ham's record against City since Pep Guardiola took over at the London Stadium. But, you know, they showed that weird things can sometimes happen. The other big match over the weekend, I guess, was the FA Cup final, which was on Saturday. I saw lots of comments to the effect of, the cup is back! Do you think it is in any meaningful sense? I was kind of like, I'm not really sure why people are saying this to, you know, what, I'm not really sure what's different about this. It's, you know, another final between two of the big teams. That's usually what happens. Has there been something, some rejuvenation of the Cup? Is it just a bit of positive thinking?
I think it's probably that Liverpool fans were paying attention to the Cup and they may have been saying it because it's not something they've been doing.
So as Guardiola would have it, well, obviously you've got Liverpool in the final and suddenly people care about it.
Yeah, I'd say that's folk. And I suppose because of it, the context, again, the Cup usually matters now when there's a kind of greater context to it, and because of Liverpool's season and what they're going for and the fact that as the game went on, it became something that seemed to be pivotal for their matches to come, I think it probably injected it with more meaning. If Liverpool had finished seventh in the league and were out of the Champions League in the last 16 and had won nothing else, I don't think people would have given it as much meaning as they were giving it at the weekend. But ultimately,
so where does the meaning come from? Are you saying that this is a game where they're under pressure? If they don't win this, then they go from being a team where, whoa, you know, what a great team, you know, this will be one of those teams that's famous, you know, that people talk about in later years, to, oh, you know, what a joke, they'll be famous for losing it all.
Well, yeah, I think because they've another game on Tuesday, and when it went into extra time and players are going down, you just got this sense of an exhausted side, and could they cope with a defeat in this final for what would it mean for the rest of their matches this season? So not only would they not have the FA Cup, there would be a consequence for the remainder of the season. So I think it had that impact as well, and I think that is what the FA Cup now has. Like it has a merit if there are kind of other storylines around there, it kind of sometimes it lends a weight to them. But I don't think it's back. I think there would probably have been, if Liverpool had lost it, there would probably be a number of Liverpool fans wondering why did they go so far in the competition? Why did they have to have these games when they were in, you know, when the league and the Champions League are the trophies that they really want to win? And I think the sense of Liverpool having a kind of generational memorable season is based on everything they're doing rather than necessarily winning the FA Cup and the Carabao Cup. I think it's to do with the fact that they, you know, they've lost three matches this season in all competitions, that they are going for everything. But it is based largely around what they've done in the Premier League and in the Champions League.
You mentioned that they've lost only three in all competitions, which is an impressive number. But Gavin, why do you think they struggle so badly to win games against top opposition? I mean, this is the ninth game. I mean, if you just take English opposition, Chelsea and Man City being the two teams closest to them, and I'll add in Tottenham as well as the sort of most likely to be fourth according to the odds. So let's take Tottenham as the fourth place team. They've played nine matches against these three sides, eight draws and one win. Why can't they win these types of games more regularly?
It is strange because previously under Klopp they had a really good record in these big games, and this is going back to, you know, these are the failings of the old Rafa Benitez team, you know, when they pushed United close in 2009 but couldn't get over the line. I think they might have won the league a season earlier had they not lost home and away to Man United. I think that's right off the top of my head. I'm not sure. I think there's an element of Liverpool used to win these games in massive bursts, like goal scoring bursts, you know, you can remember doing it to City in the league and in the Champions League and like that, and they don't play like that anymore. They're a lot more, I mean, like the addition of Thiago probably symbolises that they're slightly more patient and methodical in their build-up, and they try to, like, they get through games, they manage games, they do just enough to win. I mean, you know, it would be oddly fitting if I don't think it's going to happen now. It would take a very strange run of results for Man City to win the game and win the league on goal difference, but Liverpool don't like go for the jugular to the extent where they used to, because now they know that they're secure enough at the back that they can just do enough to get through games. But I think that that has maybe affected them in those big games a little bit. Now, they did swarm all over. Oddly, in the FA Cup, you've seen them. It's been a bit of a throwback for them in the sense they swarmed over Man City in the first 20
well,
minutes.
That's the one win, the 3-2 win against Man City.
Yeah, that's the one.
It's the only win out of the nine.
And in fairness, they did swarm all over Chelsea in the first 15, 20 minutes of the cup final. And, you know, they could easily have been two or three up. You know, they did start brilliantly. But I think maybe it's partly that. There have also been in defensive lapses, like the defence isn't quite as tight as it used to be. Like, they do give up more chances than they used to
what do you put that down to because obviously the thing that gets lots of attention is the high line, and you know, let's not go into that, because I think we all understand why they're doing that. And you know, when you've got VAR offsides, a lot of these chances aren't as dangerous as it sometimes looks in real time, because a lot of these chances have been offside. But why do you think why is there that sense that it's not as good as it used to be?
I'm not sure. And look, I'm partly probably being swayed by the fact that all these, you know, there's so many of these chances are offside, but because they're not flagged, it gives you kind of a false impression of the momentum of the game, you know, that Liverpool are more secure than it actually seems in the flow of the game, because these chances aren't being flagged as early as they would have been a couple
of
seasons
ago. Is Virgil van Dijk a shadow of his former self? it's a real question. Yeah.
I don't think so. I think maybe the issue is slightly more in midfield. I mean, the midfield is a lot more creative now than it used to be. I mean, the somewhat workmanlike midfield that won them the league, two seasons ago in the Champions League, three seasons ago, you know, you had Wijnaldum and Henderson. They were almost like auxiliary fullbacks at times, allowing the other two to push on. Now you see those, well, Henderson is still there, but he plays, you know, he's pushed on a lot more. Like, Liverpool, I think, have tried to score more goals this season, and I think that it has been their most successful goal scoring season. And teams are getting a little bit better about, say, you know, identifying the space behind Alexander-Arnold and behind Robertson, and they just give up. I think Liverpool are slightly more exciting to watch than Man City, because they just give you more chances, you know, and they're so reliant on Alisson to make saves one-on-one. So I'm thinking they're not quite the impenetrable edifice that they were in those two seasons where they won the European Cup and Premier League. But look, I mean, these are small margins. Like, they might end up winning both this season, and the conversation changes. But I mean, there is a definite trend of they haven't won those big head-to-heads, and you know, you can't argue with a failure to win the league if you can't beat the teams around you.
Yeah, absolutely. And just one other thing, obviously, Rising was a good fan. I think Gavin, you already mentioned it, but you know, don't forget here, as Steve Sullivan said, we're all Irish, so maybe we're not qualified to comment on that. And maybe we are qualified to comment.
Well, I mean, as Dion mentioned, we're far more interested in the Royals than most of the English are.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think was going on there, Dion? We had a bravura performance of the Liverpool fans before the game. They booed "Abide with Me." First of all, I'm not sure if they thought maybe they were about to play the anthem and just started booing, but they certainly booed "God Save the Queen," and they booed the sad figure of Prince William, which prompted angry headlines in some of the tabloid press over there the next day. Can you explain to us what was going on there?
I think it's kind of obvious what Liverpool and Liverpool supporters would think of the British establishment, if you want to call it that. And
isn't Jacob Rees-Mogg a Liverpool supporter?
Excuse me?
Jacob Rees-Mogg is a Liverpool supporter, is he?
Is he, yeah.
Well, definitely his kids are, I'm not sure how
right, okay.
Passionate he is.
Well, I think, yeah, that's... I think he probably watches from afar, and or maybe he gets his kid's nanny to who was his nanny, I think, as well, to watch the games with them. I can't imagine Rees-Mogg watches them. I think it's been a standard for Liverpool in cup finals for many years. I can remember Liverpool and Everton fans. Now, there were obviously circumstances then as well, but that were particular to the occasion. But Liverpool and Everton fans chanting Merseyside over "God Save the Queen" in the 1989 Cup Final after Hillsborough. And if you look at Hillsborough and you look at what happened with Hillsborough, the way that the families have had to fight for justice on that on that tragedy alone is reason enough for Liverpool fans to be booing the national anthem. And, you know, if people feel sorry for poor, forsaken Prince William, then I think he's gonna be okay. I think it's unfortunate in the sense that it's become, you know, people. I expect this week to unfold with Boris Johnson being asked what he thought about Liverpool fans booing the national anthem and Prince William, and which allows him to, you know, to kind of ratchet up another front in the culture war. But I didn't think it was notable or significant at all. If you understand Liverpool history and its sense of feeling slightly separate from the rest of England. So I think the abide with me thing, I agree. I think there was some confusion about what was coming next, and that's why abide with me was booed, because I don't think it's anything that Liverpool supporters would have any issue with, and the rest of it then just becomes another one of these issues that people are happy to, people like Boris Johnson are happy to answer questions about, rather than talking about the things that really actually matter to people.
Gavin, the relegation situation is kind of amazing at the moment. I was just sure Everton would win. I wasn't sure Everton would win, but they had the opportunity to win and finally secure safety, which they haven't done now. So it's going to be such a nervy week for them. Leeds got a late equaliser. Burnley, sort of as expected, lost to Spurs, although maybe some people felt it unluckily so. It's set up quite well for the last week. But I suppose the question is, who do you see going down out of those three?
All logic keeps telling me that Everton won't go down, but they do quite... They do appear to be quite determined to do so.
They just can't quite get out of it.
Ugh. I think maybe Burnley, but I say that with absolutely no confidence. I just feel like, and again, this is just me investing in something that doesn't really make sense, but I feel like they've invested in their new manager bounce. They've got a very good return from it, actually. But now it feels like it's, you know, creeping down a little bit. But I mean, so what did I watch? I watched Everton Brentford on Sunday. Like, Everton games, particularly at Goodison in the last few weeks, have been appointment television. They've been absolutely...
They're unbelievable, yeah.
They've been absolutely magnificent. And, like, you know, I have this caricature in my head of Frank Lampard as, you know, quite, you know, a stiff, upper-lipped English gentleman. He's hysterical and he's chaotic. It's been amazing. It's been amazing to watch. And I think, in fairness, like... I think I don't think he is the best manager in the world. And I'm not sure if he keeps them up how much longer he lasts at Everton. Like, I mean, there's no rhyme or reason, or there doesn't seem to be any kind of methodical process to what he's doing there. I mean, I was looking at it earlier on. I think only once since he took charge has he kept the same formation after a defeat. Now, that's partly been, you know, his hand has partly been forced by injury and so on. And he has had a bad run of injuries. But, you know, there is something kind of quite reactive and quite chaotic about him. He's like that on the sideline. But I think what he has done is leaned into the chaos a little bit, and he has ridden the wave of the Everton crowd. Like, I mean, Everton can count themselves lucky that they're having this season... this year rather than last year. Like, I mean, if this was happening last year in the empty stadia, I do think that they'd be gone already.
You think the crowd is the only thing keeping them up?
Maybe not fair to say the only thing keeping them up, but I mean, it had a massive impact, particularly in that game against Chelsea. Wasn't that decided by Azpilicueta fouling up, if I'm remembering correctly? Mm-hmm. I do think that that has had a massive, massive impact. And, you know, Everton are, you could say, they're leaning into the chaos. They didn't manage it well yesterday with Braithwaite getting sent off very early. I think that crowd has had a massive impact. I know they did finally win an away game, was it against Leicester? But the home form is what's going to keep them in the division. And, you know, we've heard a lot about the Goodison groan, and I mean, Everton fans would have a lot of reason to be, in open revolt, like they were earlier on in the season, to be honest, like toward the board, etc. But they have come together, and for all of Lampard's drawbacks and frailties and weaknesses as a manager, he has ridden that wave quite well. So the Palace game, I think that's at home on Thursday, and if they win that, they're safe. Again, I don't have any confidence that they will win it. And then it's Arsenal the weekend, and I know that Everton fans might be thinking that, God, Arsenal be gunning for top four. We would have liked to have them have that tied up before the last game of the season. But history teaches us, I think you're better off facing Arsenal when they have something to play for than not, because I think that makes them more vulnerable.
Yeah, it's such a nervy week. You say you're a Leeds fan, Dion. You're just sitting there all week waiting to see what happens in the Everton-Burnley game. Because at the moment, the point they got at the weekend looks really good in that it was really late on. It was in injury time and it takes them out of the relegation zone. But that's dependent on Burnley, on what Burnley do on Thursday. So Burnley are away to Villa, as Gavin says. Everton at home to Crystal Palace on Thursday night. And then it's down to the last day of the season. What way do you see all this shaking up?
I think Leeds are going to go down.
Yeah, you're backing Burnley.
Well, yeah, I just think it's like Leeds have been so terrible, and it really saddens me. I would like Leeds to stay up, but I just think if Burnley get a point even on Thursday, it's just, you know, you're just asking Leeds then to win their last game of the season, more than like just,
well, maybe a draw, because if Burnley were to get a point, they'd be level with Leeds now with much better goal difference, so then potentially a draw for Leeds would be enough on the last day if Burnley were to lose on the last day.
Maybe that's Leeds' pathway is just complete implosions all around them.
Everything need to be Crystal Palace though, because playing against Arsenal is no good.
I think Everton will beat Palace. I think they will. Like, now we talked about this earlier. You would have said that they were going to beat Watford and Brentford in the last 2 matches, and said they've come out with 1 point from those. So anything is possible with them. But I think if that game is such, that's it. You win that and you're done. Now, I know they had that against Brentford as well. And the manner in which the ways they find to sabotage themselves are, as Gavin says, kind of just remarkable. It's kind of relentless. But I do think they should beat Palace, and then it is between Burnley and Leeds. And I just feel like, you know, Leeds got, you know, it was a great point to get against Brighton, but it's just, again, that's a game you think, right, this is to be scraping a point in that match doesn't suggest that you're really that it's going to work out well for you.
You've both politely avoided mentioning Seamus Coleman's screamer of an own goal, the glancing header. So we'll like, Coleman's had enough stick, I think, this season. So we'll leave that.
You put the boot into him there. I'm just, yeah.
Well, it was unfortunate. I mean, listen, we all love Seamus Coleman, but we'll wrap things there. Thanks, Dion. Thanks, Gavin.
Thank you.
It happened to be on the dart.
It's time to get busy, this motherfucker.
Like we always do about this time.
Okay, I'm going to reveal a piece of information now. Well, I haven't smoked a cigarette in 4 days.
What I'm saying is to this guy, cheer up. How about you wake up?
Last time I took the dart, I was offered a spliff.
Wake up. Wake up to what's happening in the world.
Hey, Pat, do you want a spliff? You know.
A fair bit covered today, as always, on Monday's football podcast, Ken. But one story that I'm trying to remember when this started snowballing. We might have been in London at the time.
Yeah, we were around.
Yeah, so I don't think we've actually covered the Newcastle... The new jersey. There's a little bit of a controversy over their proposed jersey for next season.
Well, you know, the reason we didn't mention it, because it would have fit in very well into the chat we were having on stage. But the reason is that at that point, I was still assuming it was a joke, or it was a fake, or it was a wind-up, a troll. Like, when I saw it, I was like...
That was with John Bruin and Lars Sivertsen, yeah.
Because we discussed some issues of... sports washing and so on and so forth, and, you know, Messi being out in Saudi Arabia and just
Erling Haaland's personality, which is a slightly different kettle of fish, but it's good. We'll try and play some of this for you later in the week. Whatever's still viable at that point. But what we didn't talk about was Newcastle, because I didn't realize that, because you thought there were people just taking the piss.
Well, I was like, is this real? I couldn't be sure that it was real, and I didn't want to be in the position of, oh, we've just spent, you know, a few minutes talking about something which turns out to be fake. So So unfortunately, we didn't talk about it, but like, so they put out, leaked these images showing a Newcastle, you know, second kid or third kid, I'm not sure which is essentially just a copy of the Saudi national team home shirt. It's just, it's a white shirt with like green trim. It looks a bit like an Ireland away shirt, you know. Green badge, Newcastle badge in green, all green and white. It's just like, you can't, are you serious? This is, but
it's literally Saeed O'Aran, you know, from
yeah,
like it's the exact jersey that he was wearing as he ran 80 yards to score that goal.
Some goal, Omerf.
Ah, unbelievable.
It was a bit of a kind of a, there was a few ricochets, fortuitous ricochets off the screen.
Ken, would you piss
I don't think
that moment from him.
I don't think it's among the top World Cup goals, actually, just because he ran from a long way out, you know. I think it was a little, it was an element of fortune.
Listen, I'm not putting it in the top 10 of Anton here. I'm just saying it was a bloody good goal. That's all I'm saying.
It was, I mean, if you're looking back at the entire history of Saudi Arabia.
No, let me speak.
Let me finish.
If you look back through all Saudi Arabia's games in the World Cup, tell me that's not the highlight, Ken. Just tell me, say those words to me.
No, I won't. I think it probably was the highlight. There that and the moment where Gianni Infantino looked to first to Vladimir Putin and then to Mohammed bin Salman with a kind of a grin on his face, and they all had a little chuckle. That was a real high point as well. But what I was surprised was to see some reaction from Newcastle, which was strongly against this. When, as far as I can see, all other aspects of the Saudi takeover by it have been warmly welcomed so far. So I'm thinking, what's the difference here? Like, what imaginary line has been crossed here? I mean, there were obviously still some voices who were strongly in favour. You know, this is smart business. You know, this is just smart business. You know, we'll sell more shirts in Saudi Arabia. You know, like, you're going to sell so many shirts in Saudi Arabia. Like, maybe, I just, maybe, I mean, there's 35 million people who could sell 70, 80 million home of these Newcastle home shirts. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised if that happened. But more often I saw a kind of a, oh, hang on, I'm not sure about this. And I just thought, well, what's the problem here? Is it just that this makes it too obvious? What's happened here?
Jersey to own the libs.
Yeah, no, I mean, come on. Well, I mean, there are some people who are doing that, but there were people who were like, no, I'm not sure this is too much. I can see Luke Edwards, for instance, in the Daily Telegraph was writing, many fans feel this is too much to stomach. It feels too blatant. It gives the impression Newcastle are being used. And I thought, well, yeah, it does give that impression. And that's the problem. It spells out explicitly what's just been kind of implicit until now, you know, which is that Newcastle fans are like, you know, the parents of a cuckoo. You know what I mean? They're like those little birds that are bringing up. They've got a cuckoo in the nest, and they're kind of coming along and standing with, you know, encouraging it on its way, and it's going to grow up to hitherto unheard of dimensions. They're tending to this thing that's where they're at, and this is like, oh, the cook, this thing looks a bit weird. I mean, this plumage that the thing is developing doesn't look like either of us. But I suppose that's just the way it is. And I just think, come on, like, you got to take the rough with the smooth, surely, right? You know, if you've been bought out as a kind of a, and you're now a marketing vehicle for Saudi Arabia, then, you know, suck it up. Suck it up. Like,
is it because it's the shirt, Ken, in inverted commas, and or capitalized, whatever.
It's right there in front of your eyes.
That's the way people, and I know it's not, but it's not just physical. There's a symbolic, you know, when people talk about their club, right? There's, you know, you talk about various parts of it, but no. Okay, some people do care a lot about the stadium, and certainly back in the day when naming rights first started happening, that was, you know, there were some issues with that. I'm not just talking about Newcastle, I mean, like various clubs in various sports. But really, when what gets people worked up is the idea of representing the shirt or the jersey. You know, that's always talked about. That's the most emblematic thing of the club more than anything else. I'm just trying to, again, you thought I successfully got into Pep Guardiola's head. I'm now trying the even trickier task of getting into the head of Newcastle fans who suddenly think this is the line that cannot be crossed after all the lines that the Saudis have crossed in recent times. Yeah. And there's something about the jersey that feels like it's on a different emotional plane to anything else to do with the club.
Well, you can't ignore it, right? I mean, you can ignore the other stuff, but this is right there. You've got Newcastle literally running around in Saudi Arabia costumes, you know what I mean? Like, you can't, it's just, you can't just put it to the back of your mind or pretend it's not a thing that's happening. I mean, you can see it literally there. But I read I always like to read Lugaiter's articles as an indication of, I mean, he's covering obviously the story, so we'll see. And as I read the article, it's the one that I mentioned earlier, which he'd said it feels too blatant. It gives the impression Newcastle are being used. It sort of turns into a bit of a complaint of it, like a kind of a whine about Saudi Arabia not having given enough money yet. You know, Telegraph Sport understands the kit was chosen in conjunction with the manufacturer Castore, but someone at the club signed it off. Someone had to think it was a good idea. Perhaps the most ludicrous thing is that beyond Premier League survival, Newcastle haven't really received any of the benefits of being owned by PIF yet. They're the richest club in the world in nickname only. They're not behaving like it. I thought, what? Weren't they the top spending club in the world in the January transfer window?
Yeah, but Chris Wood doesn't roll off the tongue in Riyadh.
That's true. That's very, very true. Although, you know, I guess that was Eddie Howe's call. Only this week, manager Eddie Howe, following similar off-the-record briefings by members of the club's board, warned there would not be a huge amount of money invested this summer. Words like prudence have been bandied about.
The dirtiest word of all.
The dirtiest word. Prudence.
Get that word prudence out your fucking mouth, Ken. Jesus.
PIF have pumped significant money in, around 100 million since October, but they have not shown any willingness yet to sign the sort of generous sponsorship packages that have turned Manchester City, owned by the ruling family in Abu Dhabi, into one of the world's richest and most powerful football clubs. The world's richest, actually, the world's highest earning. So far, all they have got to show for being effectively owned by the Saudi state is 93 million in the January transfer window.
Well, look, maybe they're sticklers for financial fair play. They just don't want to potentially get on the wrong side of anybody at UEFA or elsewhere.
Maybe they believe in, you know, waiting until the transfer window opens for them to start spending more money on transfers. Look, maybe that's it. Maybe that's the thing they're planning.
All they've got to show for effectively being owned by the Saudi state is 93 million in the January transfer window, 25 million of which was spent on the 30-year-old Chris Wood from Burnley, who, as you say, doesn't roll off the tongue in Riyadh. Where is all the Saudi money that was hinted at when fans were celebrating the takeover? Where are the new sponsorship deals? Why is Howe operating with such a relatively small transfer budget this summer? Again, we don't know what the transfer budget is, but all we know is that Newcastle haven't been going around saying, we're going to spend untold obscene sums of money in the transfer window this season, which would be kind of a crazy thing for them to put about before they actually had to start doing deals. Maybe the fact this is only a change in kit colours is the problem. Newcastle are being dressed up to look like the Saudi national team, but the might of the Saudi state has not been used, at least not yet, to make them resemble a successful football team.
So not enough sports washing. Gotcha. No.
Well, it's like, it's just you haven't paid enough for that shirt. It reminds me of, actually, I don't know if you've seen Les Miserables, the bargain with the Thénardiers, when Jean Valjean comes to buy Cosette from, like, the corrupt innkeeper and his wife who've been looking after her.
Oh, remember, the innkeeper.
Of course.
Thénardier. What to say, shall you carry our treasure away? What a gem, what a pearl, beyond rubies is our little girl. How can we speak of debt? Let's not haggle for darling Colette. Cosette. Look, all I'm saying, Owen, is...
Oh, wow.
Look, the deal just needs to be sweetened. You know, if Saudi Arabia wanted to, change the colours, change the crest, you know, all that stuff, whatever it is they want to do, you just need to throw a little, you cross the palm of silver. You can't be giving this stuff away, you know?
Beautiful voice, Ken. Haven't heard that for too long.
I can't wait to see the next idea that we see rolling off the conveyor belt at Newcastle.
It's the final week of the Premier League, the title race, fourth place, relegation, all still to play for over the next few days. So we will obviously have coverage throughout the week on the World Service. You'll need to be a member to hear all of that. Thanks, Ken.
Thank you, Owen.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you, Musical Theatre. That's all I can say.
Thank you, Victor Hugo.
What to do, what to say? Shall you carry a treasure away? What a gem, what a pearl. Beyond rubies is our little girl. How can we speak of debt? Let's not haggle for darling Cosette. Dear Fontaine, gone to rest. Have we done for your child what is best? Share that bread, share each bone.
treated her like she's one of her own, like her own.
That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine, it's not that at all. It's the opposite of that, it's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.